Explaining football to the friend who's just there for the nachos? Hard. Tailgating from home like a pro with snacks and drinks everyone will love? An easy win. And with Instacart helping deliver the snack time MVPs to your door, you're ready for the game in as fast as 30 minutes. So you never miss a play or lose your seat on the couch or have to go head-to-head for the last chicken wing. Shop game day faves on Instacart and enjoy $0 delivery fees on your first three grocery orders. Offer valid for a limited time. Other fees and terms apply.
I'm John Oran, Puck's sports correspondent, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity, where I will take you inside the executive suites and owner's boxes that run the entire sports business. Twice a week, I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media and give you a window into the inside conversations that are happening throughout sports media. So be sure to follow and listen to The Varsity Podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, 909, the Cato Institute, their mission is to, according to their website, keep the principles, ideas, and moral case for liberty alive for future generations while moving public policy in the direction of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. With that, we welcome in Adam Michel, Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, because everybody wants to know these days, Adam, you know, where you're coming from, et cetera. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for the introduction.
Well, we added, where are you coming from? Where do we find you today?
I am in Washington, D.C.
All right, let's talk. This is Tax Policy 101, because a lot of claims are made during election season. A lot of counterclaims are made. We got former President Trump saying he wants to eliminate taxes on tips, and we got Vice President Kamala Harris saying she wants to eliminate tax on tips. We got former President Trump saying he wants to eliminate taxes on overtime. I don't know if Kamala Harris has weighed in on that yet. I don't want to pay taxes on my income. Do you, Adam?
No, I don't. And that's, I think, the impetus behind a lot of these proposals that are being floated out in campaign season. I think they ultimately come down to currying favor with special constituencies, whether it be Trump announced his no taxes on tip proposal while campaigning in Nevada, where they have some of the highest proportion of tipped service workers. But ultimately, if you exempt certain types of income from certain people from the income tax, it means everyone else's taxes have to be higher. And I'm a fan of lowering taxes for everyone, not just for certain constituencies.
Who is exempt from taxes now while we talk about that? If we're talking about expanding people who don't pay taxes on tips, you're not going to pay taxes on overtime, which, again, we'll get to the mechanics of how that could actually happen, if it would actually happen later on. But are there groups that now are exempt from paying income, taxes on income?
So the income tax ostensibly applies sort of to most sort of wage income. However, there's generous deductions that exempt the your sort of first $12,000-$24,000 of income, depending on sort of whether you're married or not. And so if you're lower income, you tend to pay very little, if any, income tax, especially if you have kids and you take the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit. So there are some people that are effectively exempt from the income tax, but right now there are not certain types of income like is being proposed sort of broadly exempted from the income tax.
I don't know if it was a combination of my kid turning 21, which I just did the math and realized this, with the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and me losing that exemption, would it be, I guess? Is that the word? Yes.
Right. The child tax credit. Yeah.
Child tax credit. That's what it was. But with the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act made my taxes go up, and I don't make that much money, but I lost deductions because the standard deduction went up. Take me through the 2017, that was under former President Trump, correct? Tax Cuts and Jobs Act?
Correct. Yeah, in 2017, Republicans in Congress, signed by former President Trump, passed one of the largest tax reform packages in almost 30 years since under Reagan. And your position is abnormal. Most Americans either saw no change in taxes or saw a tax cut. The average tax cut was just shy of $1,500, sort of averaging across all Americans. And as a percentage of taxes paid, the largest tax cuts went to the lowest income Americans, although higher income Americans do pay the largest portion of income taxes. And so they saw the largest dollar value tax cut overall. There was lots of different changes. It didn't just lower rates, but it doubled the child tax credit, as you mentioned. It doubled the standard deduction. It put limits on itemized deductions like the state local tax deduction, which may have been what you were impacted by. But all of that expires at the end of 2025 when Americans are facing about a $400 billion across-the-board automatic tax increase if Congress doesn't do anything, and that's why tax policy is such a big part of the current campaign cycle.
This is not about me, I realize that, but I would have lost that child tax credit when the kid turned 21, right?
I think the child tax credit actually goes away when they turn 17.
Well, we don't need to bring my tax history up. Let's just let that fly. Let's talk about why do the 2017 tax cuts expire? Why do they expire in 2025? Why do they not make tax policy to go ad infinitum?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish they would. There's a bunch of arcane rules in the Senate. The way that Congress ended up passing these tax cuts essentially meant that they couldn't both cut taxes permanently and pass the package through the Senate budget rules, and so a lot of tax policy is unfortunately done in these sort of temporary packages that really just obscures the budgetary impact of the tax cuts and makes tax planning, business investment, people planning for their future more challenging. And so one of the messages I think that Congress needs to hear as they're considering what to do with these tax expirations is not only should they keep taxes simple and keep taxes low, but they should make whatever changes they decide on permanent so that people have sort of certainty in their lives rather than seesawing back and forth between different types of tax policies.
Well, when I think about the 2017 tax cut, that started as taxes you could fill out on a postcard, did it not?
Yes, Republicans have been claiming you'll be able to fill out your taxes on a postcard for decades now. That's always the ideal that they're pushing for. But the fact of the matter is the tax code, your sort of taxes are complicated because of all of the special deductions and exemptions and tax credits that are politically popular. And it's incredibly difficult for Congress to scale a lot of these things back. And so I think that they should continue to make progress in that direction of removing all these special rules that make taxes so complicated. But as we started the conversation, both former President Trump and Vice President Harris are going in the opposite direction. Both of them have a long list of new tax preferences, new deductions, new tax credits that will only make our tax code more complex and more burdensome and ultimately require tax rates to go up on everyone as you're punching more holes in the tax base. If Washington needs a certain amount of revenue to function, it means ultimately tax rates have to go up on everyone else.
So here in Louisiana, we're familiar with that. Russell Long quoted as saying, "Don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the fella behind the tree." We're also familiar with fiscal cliffs, and you say the nation is looking at a 2025 fiscal cliff. Talk about that, Adam, if you will.
Yeah, so at the end of 2025, so in 2026 is when taxes actually increase, but the Congress will be facing a bunch of fiscal deadlines. They'll be facing the debt limit will be coming back, and there's a bunch of pandemic era subsidies. A larger Affordable Care Act healthcare subsidy expires at that time as well, and these the 2017 tax cuts largely go away over the sort of 10-year budget window that folks in D.C. like to talk about. It's a more than a $4 trillion tax increase. If Congress does nothing, we already have $2 trillion annual budget deficits. And so all of this, the both the spending side and the tax side, are going to come to a head next year. And it's going to be a really important inflection point for Congress to hopefully get our fiscal house in order. I'm an optimist. I hope that they'll approach that fiscal cliff with sort of clear eyes and sort of rationalize the federal budget by reining in a lot of the spending that is out of control here in Washington. But it'll certainly be a big discussion.
The only problem I have, Adam, or concern I have is that, you know, it's kind of hard to look at tax policy without factoring in politics. And when you say 2026, first thing I think of, even though we've not yet had the presidential election, is midterms.
Yeah, I mean, well, they're going to have to do something. And so there's a lot of talk that they're going to try to address these tax increases early in this next Congress. And that's ultimately what Congress usually does. They do all the difficult things they have to do in the first year. And then the second year is right back into campaign mode. So I think ultimately, if the voters are demanding that we have a simpler and tax code that takes less of our money in a rational federal budget that only spends as much as they take in, that it's the voters that ultimately put pressure on our members. And so that's my hope is that message gets through.
Rational. That's optimistic. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking to Adam Michelle, Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, about what President Trump is promising, what former President Trump is promising, what Vice President Kamala Harris and presidential candidate is promising. Nobody wants to pay taxes. We all have to. You also have to get a control on the spending side of it, or else you just continue to run up debt and deficit, which, by the way, is happening. So we'll continue the conversation when we come back. If y'all have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. And there are no dumb questions. I would like to know when we come back, and I'll start my question with Adam, with if these 2017 tax cuts go away, who's going to wind up paying more and how much more and how that could affect the economy? 921, Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm John Aran, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity. I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media. Available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're talking to Adam Michelle, Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, about the presidential campaign and what's being promised by whom when it comes to tax policy. And this goes to down ballot races, the congressional races, the entire House up for re-election, a third of the Senate. The president can't, by executive order, create tax policy, or can he or she?
The president cannot. The tax bills have to originate in the House and make their way through both the House and the Senate, and they get signed by the president. So the Congress ultimately has the first word on tax policy.
That'd be House Ways and Means if you've ever seen Schoolhouse of Rock, right? Bill on Capitol.
Yes, correct. The Ways and Means Committee is the tax writing committee in the House, and then it's called the Finance Committee in the Senate.
So before any presidential candidate could promise anything, they would have to get it through Congress, right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay, so when it comes to the tax cuts that are going to expire and the fiscal cliff that the country is facing, you would be looking at either massive cuts or if you wait, let me get this straight. You would be looking at tax increases if these expired, or what would be the resulting effect on deficit and debt being accumulated from year to year if they were allowed to continue?
Yes, you're exactly right. If Congress does nothing at the end of 2025, beginning in 2026, taxes automatically increase on Americans across the country. In Louisiana, the average tax increase would be about $2,000. The cost, the sort of lost revenue of making those tax cuts permanent would be about $4 trillion over 10 years, or about $400 billion a year. So the current annual budget deficit, the gap between what we spend and what we raise in revenue, is about $2 trillion. So it'd be adding another $400 billion to that $2 trillion number.
All right, so somebody texted in about why can't the rich be taxed? Why can't they pay their fair share? Are they paying enough taxes? Tell me about tax policy as it relates to different income groups and the effect it has on the economy.
So the effect on the economy is incredibly important, and one of the other pieces of this tax cut that is actually currently expiring right now is not just taxes on individuals, but taxes on businesses. There were some really important incentives for businesses to invest in physical things in America, in factories, in equipment, in new technology. And so the expiration of those also has impacts for domestic investment, job growth, wage growth, and sort of broader sort of economic trends, which is really important. To your question about sort of whether or not the rich pay their fair share and whether or not they can pay more, I think it's really important to start with the fact that the higher income Americans pay the disproportionate amount of taxes already. So the income tax is something like the top 10% of Americans pay almost 70% of the total income tax burden. And data from the Biden-Harris Treasury shows that the highest income Americans, the 0.01%, pay some of the highest effective tax rates when you include sort of all federal taxes. And so you can raise taxes on the rich to get a little bit more revenue, but there's not enough income earned by high-income Americans to pay for our current deficit, let alone any additional spending. The reality of the way that the European Union pays for their large government is not with just high taxes on the wealthy, but with high taxes on everyone, on the middle class, on the poor, sort of all the way up and down the income distribution. And so the idea that we can just keep funding the current government we have by only taxing a smaller segment of wealthy Americans is just mathematically not possible. And eventually something has to break. We either need to increase taxes on all Americans, or we need to reduce the amount of money Washington is spending.
Let's talk about the spending side of it, if we can. Adam, I presume you're well-versed in that. And for people, sometimes they tend to go towards some obvious things, but that's not where the most money is spent, right?
That's correct. There's people often say that we need to go after waste, fraud, and abuse, which we do, and that we spend too much money on the military and foreign interventions and foreign aid, which we do. All of those things should be on the table. But the main drivers of our budget problems are spending on sort of a broad set of mandatory entitlement programs. And these include things like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. These are the programs that ultimately make our budget, the growth in federal spending into the future, unsustainable.
You know, and the other thing, as we talked about taxing the rich, which people, I don't think, sometimes understand how sometimes they'll hear a rumor about this or a rumor about that. But if you go through it and try to vet it, it's like, well, first of all, we got to have some definitions here, because if you're going to legislate anything or codify anything, you got to be pretty specific. So when it comes to rich, I don't know how you define that. How does the tax code, I know they don't use the word rich, they determine it how? Adam, do you know?
Yeah, there is no definition of quote unquote rich. Everyone has most people's definition of a rich person is someone that earns more money than they do, and that's a problem with a lot of these discussions about who we can tax more. That as soon as we actually, as you start putting numbers on these things, it becomes incredibly difficult to actually make the numbers work. For the top marginal income tax brackets kick in around about $500,000 a year, and if you were to not just raise those top tax rates to the 40-ish% that Biden and Harris have proposed, but instead if you say raise it to 100% and confiscated every dollar earned over that threshold, you still couldn't raise enough revenue to pay for the current budget deficit, let alone any additional spending. And so that's what I mean by it's just mathematically infeasible to balance our budget on the backs of rich people. There just isn't enough money there. And so ultimately you have to, Congress will need to either cut spending or think about tax increases on a broader subset of Americans.
I would suggest, Adam, that if you have a healthy family, if you're loved and you are loved, you're already rich. Hang on a second. I just wanted to get the romantic part of that in there while we talk about tax policy. Let's talk about when it comes to the entitlements. People, first of all, when you say Social Security and call it an entitlement, people freak out because they say, I paid into this, and I know the stats show people take out a lot more, right, for the most part, than they put in. However, you also have to balance that with if they were given an option to invest their money otherwise, then maybe they wouldn't be, they would be taking more out, but they would be taking it from somewhere else, right? Take me through all that.
So Social Security, you're right, is, I think it's a misnomer that it's a fully funded program that you've paid into and you're just getting your money out. People, most people receive more out than they put in, but the reverse is also true. If the government didn't force you to save through this government savings program, but instead you were able to invest your own tax dollars in the stock market like we do in a 401k or an IRA, any individual would be much better off and get a much better return on their investment. And so whatever the story that has been told about Social Security, the fact is that it is going broke. There's not enough money to cover the obligations that have been promised to people, and that if Congress does sort of nothing in Social Security and the trust fund runs out in several years, the beneficiaries will be facing a cut in proportion to the amount of money that is coming in. They have to legally balance these two things out, and so this is another fiscal cliff that is ahead of us that Congress will have to tackle.
Let's talk about tariffs, because there's a lot of back and forth on tariffs. And that goes too, also, I think, under the subheading of taxing a business. Can you, or does it get passed along to the consumer? Your thoughts on that, Adam?
Yeah, tariffs are taxes paid on imports into the United States, and the cost is usually almost entirely passed on to the end user in the form of a higher price. They're incredibly economically distortionary. Trade is sort of the lifeblood of our modern economy, and putting limits on that trade will make it harder for for domestic industries to get the inputs they need to build more things here in America. And it is a really poor way to raise revenue.
So can you tax a business? You understand what I'm saying? Can you tax a business?
Correct. Yeah. So businesses may write the check to the government, but they always pass that cost on to someone else. Businesses are made up of people, and those people are ultimately the ones that bear the cost of the tax. So in the case of like the corporate income tax, it can either be paid by the investors, the consumers, or the workers in the form of lower returns on their investment, higher prices on the products that they sell, or lower wages they pay to their workers. And unfortunately, the economic evidence shows that workers pay most of the corporate income tax in the form of lower wages. About 75% of the cost of the corporate tax is passed on to workers, the rest to investors. Something similar happens in tariffs, except it largely gets passed on to consumers in the form of higher prices.
So, Adam, let me ask you this before I let you go. Looking to the future, when it comes to and I don't want to get too inside the beltway here, but when it comes to earmarks, lobbies, midterms, partisanship, leadership or lack thereof, us against them, how in the world can you tell me or give me some hope that any politician is actually going to show the leadership in a bipartisan manner, which would have to be done to address this? Because I don't see it happening. Thoughts?
I mean, it's going to be an incredibly interesting year next year. I think the silver lining is that almost everyone agrees in Washington, both Harris and Trump have said that they support maintaining most of the 2017 tax cuts. The debates will really be around the edges about what additional, whether or not there should be tax increases on some businesses or wealthy individuals, and what additional tax credits they want to add. Hopefully, fiscal reality makes a lot of those sort of add-ons difficult. But it really depends on who voters send to Washington and what the mandate is. I hope the mandate is for fiscally rational outcome that addresses both spending and keeps taxes low. But that's ultimately up to the voters. Mm.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Adam. I hope you come back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I would love to.
Something happens. When it comes to this no tax on tips, no taxes on overtime, is there any way that gets through any type of Congress that you can envision?
I think no tax on overtime is trickier. There's probably a way to get a very limited deduction for tipped income through Congress, but it is just one more add-on that makes the conversation all that much more challenging. So my hope is that we focus on lowering taxes for everyone. But unfortunately, the sort of political game often mucks things up.
Thank you, Adam. Just trying to keep it real. Adam Michel, Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, 941, 19 till 10, traffic now, WWO. 9:48, 12 till 10, Wednesday, September the 18th. But I'm going to tell you what, before you know it, in the blink of an eye, it's going to be time to get on a plane and head to see Grandma and so forth. If the Carpenters would ever start singing here, you know where I'm going with this. We're joined by our friend, Henry Hartefelt. There you go. Travel industry analyst at Atmosphere Research Group, travel industry market research firm. How you doing, Henry?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm well. How are you?
Good, sir. Good to talk to you as always. Tell me what's going on with Boeing and a strike?
Yes, sir. So last Friday, Boeing and one of its largest labor unions representing approximately 33,000 Boeing employees in the Seattle, Washington area and in Portland, Oregon, went on strike. The company had proposed a new contract. The Teamsters union approved that. They took it to the membership. 96% of the membership voted against the contract. 95% voted to strike. So there is a lot of deep-seated anger and resentment on the part of the employees who haven't had a new contract since 2008, and they clearly want something better than the one Boeing had proposed.
What kind of money do people at Assemble Aircraft make, Henry Dino?
You know, these are good-paying jobs, Tommy. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but these are jobs that are for trained professionals and reflect it. The problem is that these workers haven't had a meaningful raise in 16 years, and they believe that they are due that raise and that they should be paid considerably more. Boeing had proposed an increase that would have averaged 25% increase over 4 years. The workers want something closer to 40% over that four-year time frame.
So
today, the two sides are sitting down to restart negotiations.
So how important is this to the people that travel? And I remember seeing all of these, looks like they're green jets, or those Boeing jets that are on the assembly line being made before they're painted. Is that what I saw, Henry?
Correct. So those planes that you're seeing have this, I think it's called a zinc chromate coating over them. That is to protect the bare metal until it can be primed and painted for airline use. The planes that are Boeing does have some management workers who will try to get some of these airplanes built, but they're not going to get very many built. During the last strike in 2008, they built only 10 airplanes a month. Right now, Boeing is building about 24 737 MAX jets a month. That's the product that's most affected. For travelers, there's really no direct impact right now. What I am worried about, though, is if this strike lasts 50 days or so, which 50 days was the length of the last one, that means it's going to take Boeing a few months to recover. They've already been struggling to get new airplanes delivered to airlines. What I'm worried about is Boeing and the airlines fall further behind for next summer 2025 travel. I know we're just winding up summer 2024, but these planes take a long time to get built, and the airlines need them to take us all the places we want to go.
So when you say the management is going to try to get some of these jets built, and when you consider the trouble that Boeing has had, trying to get these jets built is not a phrase that I think a lot of people want to hear. You with me, Henry?
I am, Tommy. So look, first, let me clarify that only qualified management workers are going to be allowed to work on the aircraft. And I'm unclear how many of those employees Boeing has. These are non-union management members who may have worked on the line before, kept current with their certifications and so on. So these are people who have the capability to build the airplanes. But as you said, you know, you want to be sure that these planes are being built by the right people. And Boeing is not going to let any airplane go out of its factory right now, especially with the FAA sitting over it, that does not meet the expected level of safety.
This may be a dumb question, Henry, but you know it's never stopped me before. Do they build these planes on spec, or do they build them for order? I would think for order, right? It's not like a car
showroom. You are correct, Tommy. So, right. So during a time like this, Boeing actually has a big backlog of orders for the 737 MAX airplane. And so right now they are building airplanes that have been ordered by airlines all over the world, as well as the companies that lease the airplanes to airlines. It's not like a real estate developer where they're building a house on spec and hoping someone comes along to buy it.
I know when it comes to the car business, floor plan, which is the financing of the vehicles, is a big factor. So I can only imagine what that would be with jets. Who is Boeing competing against for the worldwide market, and are they likely to lose any business to that competitor, whoever it is, as a result of this strike?
You know, Tommy, Boeing's primary competitor is Airbus, which builds a very wide range of aircraft from planes that seat as few as roughly 110 people to wide-body jets that can seat roughly 400. Airbus has been winning orders away from Boeing, not only because of airlines' concern over the problems with the 737 MAX, but production problems with Boeing's 787 Dreamliner, which is built in Charlotte, or outside of Charlotte. I'm sorry, it's built outside of Charleston, South Carolina. And then Airbus, though, is sold out. And so if the Boeing strike lasts a long time, we may see some airlines trying to shift. But Airbus doesn't have any room to build more planes. So airlines are really stuck.
I appreciate your time, as always, Henry. You have to come back and talk about holiday travel before too long, all right?
Absolutely.
Pleasure as always. You bet. Henry Hartefeldt, travel industry analyst, Atmosphere at Atmosphere Research Group, travel industry market research firm. We first saw him on CBS Evening News. He had a big New Orleans poster on his wall, so we called him, and he's been a good friend ever since. We'll be back, find out what Newell's got planned for us today here on WWL. So, can you tax a business? You understand what I'm saying? And the end result, can you tax a business?
Correct, yeah. So businesses may write the check to the government, but they always pass that cost on to someone else. Businesses are made up of people, and those people are ultimately the ones that bear the cost of the tax. So in the case of the corporate income tax, it can either be paid by the investors, the consumers, or the workers in the form of lower returns on their investment, higher prices on the products that they sell, or lower wages they pay to their workers. And unfortunately, the economic evidence shows that workers pay most of the corporate income tax in the form of lower wages, about 75% of the cost of the corporate tax is passed on to workers, the rest to investors. Something similar happens to in tariffs, except it largely gets passed on to consumers in the form of higher prices.
So, Adam, let me ask you this before I let you go. Looking to the future, when it comes to earmarks, and I don't want to get too inside the beltway here, but when it comes to earmarks, lobbies, midterms, partisanship, leadership, or lack thereof, us against them, how in the world can you tell me or give me some hope that any politician is actually going to show the leadership in a bipartisan manner, which would have to be done to address this? Because I don't see it happening. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be an incredibly interesting year next year. I think the silver lining is that almost everyone agrees in Washington. Both Harris and Trump have said that they support maintaining most of the 2017 tax cuts. The debates will really be around the edges about what additional, whether or not there should be tax increases on some businesses or wealthy individuals, and what additional tax credits they want to add. Hopefully, fiscal reality makes a lot of those sort of add-ons difficult. But it really depends on who voters send to Washington and what the mandate is. I hope the mandate is for fiscally rational outcome that addresses both spending and keeps taxes low. But that's ultimately up to the voters.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Adam. I hope you come back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Happens. When it comes to this no tax on tips, no taxes on overtime, is there any way that gets through any type of Congress that you can envision?
I think no tax on overtime is trickier. There's probably a way to get a very limited deduction for tipped income through Congress, but it is just one more add-on that makes the conversation all that much more challenging. So my hope is that we focus on lowering taxes for everyone. But unfortunately, the sort of political game often mucks things up.
Thank you, Adam. Just trying to keep it real. Adam Michelle, Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, 941, 19 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 948, 12 till 10, Wednesday, September the 18th. But I'm going to tell you what, before you know it, in the blink of an eye, it's going to be time to get on a plane and head to see Grandma and so forth. If the Carpenters would ever start singing here, you know where I'm going with this. We're joined by our friend, Henry Hartefeldt. There you go. Travel industry analyst at Atmosphere Research Group, travel industry market research firm. How you doing, Henry?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm well. How are you?
Good, sir. Good to talk to you as always. Tell me what's going on with Boeing and a strike.
Yes, sir. So last Friday, Boeing and one of its largest labor unions representing approximately 33,000 Boeing employees in the Seattle, Washington area and in Portland, Oregon, went on strike. The company had proposed a new contract. The Teamsters union approved that. They took it to the membership. 96% of the membership voted against the contract. 95% voted to strike. So there is a lot of deep-seated anger and resentment on the part of the employees who haven't had a new contract since 2008, and they clearly want something better than the one Boeing had proposed.
What kind of money do people at Assemble Aircraft make, Henry Dino?
You know, these are good-paying jobs, Tommy. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but these are jobs that are for trained professionals and reflect it. The problem is that these workers haven't had a meaningful raise in 16 years, and they believe that they are due that raise and that they should be paid considerably more. Boeing had proposed an increase that would have averaged 25% increase over 4 years. The workers want something closer to 40% over that four-year time frame.
So
today, the two sides are sitting down to restart negotiations.
So how important is this to the people that travel? And I remember seeing all of these, looks like they're green jets, or those Boeing jets that are on the assembly line being made before they're painted. Is that what I saw, Henry?
Correct. So those planes that you're seeing have this, I think it's called a zinc chromate coating over them. That is to protect the bare metal until it can be primed and painted for airline use. The planes that are, Boeing does have some management workers who will try to get some of these airplanes built, but they're not going to get very many built. During the last strike in 2008, they built only 10 airplanes a month. Right now, Boeing is building about 24 737 MAX jets a month. That's the product that's most affected. For travelers, there's really no direct impact right now. What I am worried about, though, is if this strike lasts 50 days or so, which 50 days was the length of the last one, that means it's going to take Boeing a few months to recover. They've already been struggling to get new airplanes delivered to airlines. What I'm worried about is Boeing and the airlines fall further behind for next summer 2025 travel. I know we're just winding up summer 2024, but these planes take a long time to get built, and the airlines need them to take us all the places we want to go.
So when you say the management is going to try to get some of these jets built, and when you consider the trouble that Boeing has had, trying to get these jets built is not a phrase that I think a lot of people want to hear. You with me, Henry?
I am, Tommy. So look, first, let me clarify that only qualified management workers are going to be allowed to work on the aircraft. And I'm unclear how many of those employees Boeing has. These are non-union management members who may have worked on the line before, kept current with their certifications and so on. So these are people who have the capability to build the airplanes. But as you said, you know, you want to be sure that these planes are being built by the right people. And Boeing is not going to let any airplane go out of its factory right now, especially with the FAA sitting over it, that does not meet the expected level of safety.
This may be a dumb question, Henry, but you know it's never stopped me before. Do they build these planes on spec, or do they build them for order? I would think for order, right? It's not like a car show.
You are correct, Tommy. So during a time like this, Boeing actually has a big backlog of orders for the 737 MAX airplane. And so right now they are building airplanes that have been ordered by airlines all over the world, as well as the companies that lease the airplanes to airlines. It's not like a real estate developer where they're building a house on spec and hoping someone comes along to buy it.
I know when it comes to the car business, floor plan, which is the financing of the vehicles, is a big factor. So I can only imagine what that would be with jets. Who is Boeing competing against for the worldwide market, and are they likely to lose any business to that competitor, whoever it is, as a result of this strike?
You know, Tommy, Boeing's primary competitor is Airbus. which builds a very wide range of aircraft, from planes that seat as few as roughly 110 people to wide-body jets that can seat roughly 400. Airbus has been winning orders away from Boeing, not only because of airlines' concern over the problems with the 737 MAX, but production problems with Boeing's 787 Dreamliner, which is built in Charlotte, or outside of Charlotte. It's built outside of Charleston, South Carolina. Airbus, though, is sold out. And so if the Boeing strike lasts a long time, we may see some airlines trying to shift. But Airbus doesn't have any room to build more planes. So airlines are really stuck.
I appreciate your time, as always, Henry. You have to come back and talk about holiday travel before too long, all right?
Absolutely.
Pleasure, as always. You bet. Henry Hartefeld, travel industry analyst, Atmosphere Research Group, travel industry market research firm. We first saw him on CBS Evening News. He had a big New Orleans poster on his wall, so we called him, and he's been a good friend ever since. We'll be back, find out what Newell's got planned for us today here on WWL.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Knorr sides and bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Knorr Taste Combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit Knorr.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.
I'm John Aran, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity. I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media. Available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.